Future Friday.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Future Friday. Here with Hamish Hallett and John Beasy. And today we're going to be talking about a very interesting topic called futurology. So if anyone doesn't know what futurology is, it's pretty much the study of looking into like the future, pretty much, like any possible, probable and preferable futures. And it's talking about like the worldwide views and myths that are, that can underline them. So yeah, it's pretty much part of the social sciences and parallel to the field of history. So looking at like historical aspects of it, looks at the past, but then futurology is considering the future. So John, you know a bit more than me than this subject. What kind of would you say is the basis of futurology, would you say?
I would say the basis of it is open-mindedness.
Okay.
Is to be open to challenging the assumptions on how any given system works. When we go about our daily lives and we have ideas and assumptions about how the future works. You know, we think about, well, you know, we look at the weather forecast and see what we might do tomorrow and plan our day around it. We have basic ideas about the future. We have basic ideas about what we want to do after we graduate or whatever, or what we want to do 5 years from now. But all those ideas are going to have assumptions baked into them. Some of them we recognize, and other ones we don't even know we aren't even aware of. Mm-hmm. And so the point of futurology and future studies is meant to show us the limitations of those assumptions and to show us how things might change in the future. Because as you were saying about it being parallel to history, if you look in history, you can see the countless different ways that people have organized themselves socially, politically, and economically. And to think that the way we're going to organize ourselves 20, 30, 50, 100 years in the future is going to be the same.
Yeah, cool.
That's quite the assumption. Hmm. So there's an image that we'll put in the show notes called the cone of plausibility. Mm-hmm. So think of it as two triangles where the top point meet each other. That's where we are in the present. One triangle going to the back is history. And so you can see as you go further and further back in history, the edges of the triangle go further and further apart. Yes. Meaning you go further and further back into history, the further and further, the more and more you can interpret what history was. Yesterday, pretty narrow, you can't really mess around with what history was. It was pretty concrete. Go back 50 years, 500, 1,000, and it becomes more and more ambiguous what exactly happened, and it becomes easier and easier to create different narratives and interpret different events in different ways. And going forward, you have the same thing where you can have, as you move further and further into the future, it becomes harder and harder to predict what it could be. You know, tomorrow, we don't think it's not going to be radically different than what we saw, you know, today and the day before. But next week, 2 years from now, a decade, 50, 100, it's going to be pretty different. And so we can imagine that there's a little line going through the triangle, and that's kind of what we think is what we think the future is going to go. We expect the future to be like that. But as you move further along the future, there's more and more possibility for deviation. And that's what futurology is meant to prepare us for, is to show us how it can deviate, how it might differ, and how the world might be different in the future. And so we can prepare ourselves and be open for those changes.
Yeah. No, when you were discussing about that subject, about that kind of idea, I was like, oh, that's really fascinating, just to kind of like hear about it. And it's the fact that I think as human beings, I think we are naturally wanting to predict everything. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I think we just can't predict everything in the world. And I think it's good to have that open-mindedness. So yeah. Things like having parallel futures or alternative futures as well. I feel like futurology kind of speaks about that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not about predicting the future. It's about seeing what the possible futures could be. Yeah. They don't care about probability. What they care about, plausibility. Mm. If it's something that could happen, it's something that's worth considering. Because it's the... You can like make a little matrix about something, whether something is high impact, high probability, or low probability. And, you know, the high impact, high probability stuff, that's the things that are getting reported on you know, the newspapers. That's what's going to be like facial recognition, AI, things that are, you know, pretty mainstream. Whether that's going to happen or not, it's pretty likely.
Yeah.
So it's not going to be disruptive. It's not going to change things. We're already kind of talking about it. But it's the high impact, low probability things. That's what gets disruptive, and that's what messes things up. You know, like 15 years ago, Mark Zuckerberg was nobody in his college dorm and Facebook was nothing. Now it's launching, it's, you know, going to launch a global cryptocurrency that's threatening global financial markets. No one could have seen that coming. No one could have predicted that, but people could have seen the emerging technologies coming about and see how they might have interacted with each other to view how that could have been a possible future, or how these different different technologies can interact in different ways to produce a different kind of scenario.
No, totally. I think it's, yeah, it's interesting the fact that you must have watched the Social Network film.
Back years ago.
Yeah, I kind of watched that film all the time, and it's crazy how you look at his Mark Zuckerberg story, where he was a college individual in, he went to Harvard, didn't he?
I think so.
Yeah, some big school, right? And the fact he was there, and then he just went kind of did all these kind of things, and then he's now this multi-millionaire billionaire pretty much. And it kind of shows it just shows the fact that you can't predict everyone, you can't predict certain ideas. I kind of was reading an article, actually. It was by Max Sanders from The Conversation, saying futurology, how a group of visionaries looks beyond the possible a century ago and predicted today's future. So he kind of mentioned a book, it was in 1924, a book about wireless possibilities, which actually predicted the mobile phone, which was super interesting, which I found that. The fact that in 1924 they could predict a phone is crazy. So I think there was a quote which was very interesting to see, which said, "In a few years' time, we shall be able to chat to our friends in an aeroplane and in the streets with the help of a pocket wireless set." And it's just back in 1924, when I was reading that, I was like, wow, so it was back in 1924 that someone could predict a mobile phone. So that just shows, and that goes back to this study, the fact that, it's the fact that you have all these infinite different possibilities and futures. It just opens us, our minds up. And it's now the fact that from his prediction, I don't want to say prediction, but from his, I don't want to say prediction, but what's another word? Foresight? I don't know.
Yeah, I guess it's foresight.
Foresight, yeah. But anyway, his
speculation.
Yeah, so his speculation has now led to an actual result, basically, in that sense. So it just shows it's interesting how that kind of happens. Yeah. And what are these kind of different? Because we talk about the future and all that, but what are these different types of futures that futurology tries to predict?
Well, there's generally the everyone going around their daily lives has an expected future.
Yeah.
That's what everyone has to do in order to get around their daily lives. That's a normal thing. What you kind of want to do in a lot of future studies is everyone has an idea of the future, and everyone has an idea about how a given system works. So what you want to do is try to extract that model of how a system works and what they think that future is for all people, to see what that is, to kind of get a fuller understanding of what how something is working, and then you can see how that might interact with each other. So there's the expected future, what people think is going to happen, not necessarily what really will. And you can have all sorts of different alternative futures, and then you can assign different values of, I want to avoid that, I'd like that, this is what I want. What can we do to kind of get there? Or here's a bad thing we think could happen. How could we get there? To show you the different paths of where do we want, do we want to have techno dystopia, or do you want, space communism? What do we want?
Yeah, true. And it's the fact that, because I was kind of reading it's an introductory book to futurology, and it's kind of the four types of futures. So possible, plausible, probably, and preferably as well. So you have those kind of four types of futures. How do you kind of distinguish between those four futures? Are there ways of differences between all four, or is there a way of defining each?
Well, those first three sound like they're just different levels of probability and plausibility.
Okay.
So you can, you know, you can, when you say something's plausible, you know, I can say that, you know, I don't know, Facebook's, you know, Zuckerberg's going to sell all his shares in Facebook in 2 months from now.
Mm.
Plausible, that could happen.
Yeah.
Likely, not so much. That's largely what those are going to be, just different rankings of, like, is how likely is this to happen? Is this realistic? How, which one's more realistic? And the other, last one, preferable, is mostly as a subjective opinion of, you know, is this something I want? Do I prefer this future over other futures?
Mm-hmm.
And that's largely just based on what you want for yourself or what you want for society, what you think is good, and you assign that.
Okay, fair enough.
So something to work towards.
Yeah. So it's kind of like the degree of the futures kind of thing. So it's like possible is it's probably most likely going to happen, but of course, you know, you can't say this future will definitely happen because obviously you can't predict everything. And then plausible is like it could happen, but of course, you can't be like...
Go the other way around.
Or is it the other way around?
I'd probably say the other way around.
Yeah? Okay. Yeah, yeah, in that sense. And then, but then what about probably and preferably? What are those kind of different as well between each other?
Preferably is just about whether or not, is just a statement of, do you prefer this future over others? It's not, okay, a, it's not a statement of probability, of
fair
likelihood.
Enough. Yeah.
Yeah, I would take issue just with the... I would collapse those first three categories into one.
Oh, really? Okay.
Just because... when you start assigning those kinds of things of probability and possibility, that you're starting to make it a bit more like you're trying to predict, you're trying to make us,
yeah,
you're trying to just, you're trying to, it's, even though they're all possibility, they're all plausible, and a lot of them are more likely than others, it's better to try to put them all on more even footing than not.
Sure.
Because you don't want to dismiss those potentially high impact, low probability ideas.
Mm.
You want to treat them all with some kind of degree of validity and plausibility.
Fair enough. Yeah, and you kind of, if you then try to distinguish too many, then it loses value in terms of the certain futures kind of thing. So let's say, like, yeah, if you have like you have all these four types of futures, yeah, it's the whole idea, like actually one idea can just describe, you know, all kind of futures kind of thing. So that's fair enough. And then, because for people who might not understand like futurology and things like that, what are the three sort of main like laws of the study, what would you say?
The first one would be that you can't predict the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's,
that's pretty simple.
Yeah, you can't predict it. It's, we're not, futurologists aren't psychics.
Mm-hmm.
All they're doing is making estimated guesses as to, this is what a future could look like.
Yeah.
This is not what it is. It's not what it will be. It's what it could be. In any way, shape, or form. It might not even look like that at all.
Sure.
The other one.
Oh, yes. Go ahead. So we'd have some notes, so just bear with us in a sec.
Oh, yeah. The other one is that it's not predetermined.
Yep.
This kind of goes in with it's not predictable. Mm. There's, we're operating on that there's no fate, there's no destiny. There's free will. People are able to make choices that are going to
impact the future.
You're going to impact the future.
Mm.
And then lastly is that the future is determined by the present.
Okay, yeah.
What we do has impact on the future. That's why it's important to look at preferred and baseline, like preferred and, you know, unpreferred futures,
mm-hmm,
to see what the future could be. And whether we like it or not, because the idea is that we, the present, like we're not passively going into the future and something's just going to happen to us.
Mm.
The future that we enter is a future that we create.
Cool.
We have to change it. And so we can choose whether we go into the, you know, go down the path where, you know, AI takes over and we all die,
mm-hmm,
or we can go down the path where we have luxury space communism and we all have our material goods needed, fulfilled, and, you know, and everything's great.
That's fair enough. So it's kind of like looking into like facial recognition, even though, as you can tell, I'm obsessed with this topic. because I've seen now there's been a lot of news going on around, such as the European Union now investigating facial recognition and potentially banning it. So that shows that they are at least looking at facial recognition and being like, okay, the future, we don't know if this is going to happen or not, but if we continue this road of using facial recognition without considering like privacy aspects and the legality of it, then we're going to go down to the road where it potentially, we might look like China, for example, which becomes this digital totalitarian state, right? But then now they're like, actually, let's try and halt this. Now they want to try and change their future to be like, we can try and use facial recognition, but as you've mentioned, like of these previous episodes, a good tool to use it in a way that is like manageable and isn't inflicting on those human rights issues and privacy. So it just shows like, yeah, it's kind of the fact they're kind of trying to see, look beyond the future and not trying to create that future that they don't want to have.
Exactly. That's a lot of it is you want to see how different, how any kind of a weak signal of change, any kind of instance of change, be it politically, culturally, technologically, any kind of change, any change in the world that could be disruptive. You want to see how that can interact with other changes to see how the different possibilities it can create.
Yeah.
You can see where, you know, a world where facial recognition, you know, scans your face, knows you, and, you know, I don't know, you, Xi Jinping puts out a new public announcement, you scowl, the AI sees that you're displeased with the union, you go to a re-education center. You know, you could have that.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you have facial recognitions to make it easier to get into your bank account and put something, you know, something simple and non-threatening.
Yeah. But then even, okay, staying on the topic of facial recognition, because now China has to adapt their facial recognition with the coronavirus that happened. Would futurology kind of try and consider that like major random thing happening as well? Would they consider it or not really?
What do you mean exactly?
So like, okay, so the fact the coronavirus, let's be honest, has come about very randomly, right? I'm guessing futurology probably was saying a virus might have happened, might or it could occur. Maybe. I'm not an expert, but let's say like let's not say it's coronavirus, but let's say just a random event happens and that then changes that future. Would then futurology be like, would kind of have that in their mindset? I'm not too sure, would it? I'm not too sure. I don't know how to phrase this question, but it's kind of like, would the future consider a random event that then happens in that future? Would they consider random? Would they consider a random event in that future? Yes or no? No.
I'm still not sure if I understand the question.
Understand the question. Okay. It's really hard to try and describe it. So I mean, like
whether or not they include like a variable for randomness.
Yeah, there you go. Sorry, like that. Will they consider randomness?
Sure. I mean, again, it's not a prediction.
It's
not a prediction. Yeah. It's about like, this is what could be. This is a
could
thing.
Be.
Or, you know, it just adds to the scenario. Like, okay, we've constructed this scenario of this possible future. This is how the system we think might work.
Right.
Let's throw something in there to see how that might play out.
Right.
So that's what you call scenario building.
Okay.
You build up a kind of specific future. You have a specific plan in mind, and then you can see, okay, we have an idea about how this system might work. Let's speculate what would happen if we threw something in there and see how that might go about. That's how a lot of more specific kinds of foresight work. That's a lot of the kind of foresight that the U.S. military does.
Yeah.
They don't do a lot of the kind of the broad, you know, how might the world be like in 20 years? But more like, you know, what are the, you know, what kind of militarist, you know, cyber capabilities will the Russians have in 2030 that might affect our, you know, interests in Yemen?
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Apologies for like that really bad wordy question. So I meant, yeah, it's just like, would they speculate certain things? That's the thing, because futurology has to have different types of futures, right? And I'm not saying it's predicting it.
Mm-hmm.
We need to find a different word for prediction, right? But obviously they're having different types of futures and they can speculate all they want, right? But can they speculate everything? That's what I'm maybe trying to
no,
they can't speculate anything.
Well,
it's difficult, right? Yeah.
It'd be impossible.
Yeah, there's of course just, it would.
It's,
yeah.
It's because you can't predict the future. It's not determined. There's
countless
possibilities. And the other thing is, part of this study is to show us the assumptions we're not even aware of.
Oh, okay.
And so when we see these small instances of change that might challenge an assumption, I mean, we see that, it might challenge an assumption that we don't even know we had.
Right.
And so we can't speculate about all possible futures because there's so many assumptions about how we think the world works that we're not even aware that we take for granted as an assumption.
Yeah. No, it's really interesting that, because I feel like, yeah, Because that's the thing, because I kind of felt like I never knew. Well, actually, you know what? Now think about it. The coronavirus as a case isn't relatively new, because we always have viruses. So we had like Ebola, for example, randomly coming about. So it's like, yeah, probably that was, I feel like the viruses mostly come about like most of the time anyway. So it's kind of, yeah. But then with like, obviously not trying to predict everything, are there certain things that we can predict? Surely there is.
That you can?
Well, that you can predict, yeah. Like, for example, let's take a case. This is going to be super, like a random case. Let's say, I don't know, I know, because then this is going to relate back to the third law. Mm-hmm. I was saying, like, if you have, because, okay, then, okay, let's go. But so let's say I see a bunch of sharks in, like, this lake, for example, and I then decide, well, I'm going to jump in. Obviously, I'm going to die, right? But then that's obviously then creating that future because of the third law. When you make individual choices, that then creates that future, doesn't it? Right, yeah.
The only things you can predict,
yeah,
are those that must occur by logical necessity. Like, right. Things like 2 + 2 = 4.
Yeah.
Like things that are fundamentally must be that way.
Mm.
Everything else is contingent. Sure. Everything else is historically contingent.
Okay. That's fair enough.
The world we live in today is only a product of the past, just yes. as the future is a product of today.
Mm, yeah. And do you think that's our today's world is accelerating pretty, pretty quickly? Do you feel that now our today's world is now becoming more and more of our future? Do you feel? Or no?
What do you mean?
So like, okay, sorry. I'm saying these really bad worded questions, but like, do you think the world is accelerating so quickly that the futures that they have out there, right, that the futurologists aren't predicting but just having there, is our today's world accelerating so quickly that is now matching those futures?
No.
No, do you
We're
don't
not
think
there
so?
Yet.
Not there yet.
Well, the futurology is often looking at, you know, 10, 15 years down the line.
Okay.
You know, they're looking at, yeah. you know, a highly digitalized global labor economy. You know, all, you know, digital labor platforms where everyone gets their jobs or specific tasks off, you know, Fiverr and other online labor platforms. You'll have distributed manufacturing, personal AI assistants, you know, so many things that we don't have yet.
Mm.
Like, yeah, the world's changing faster, but every day that the world changes, you have another future. You have a futurist going into work.
Oh, yeah.
Speculating about, you know, seeing the latest thing or whatever and incorporating that into their projections.
Enough. So it's way more like long term rather than
short
term. It's long
term.
So yeah.
It's not about it's not about granular detail. It's not about you know, I had one person ask me after my internship about whether or not the day-to-day proceedings of parliament affect futurology, and like, no, it doesn't, because it's not about, you know, whether or not the Speaker of the House got upset with some backbencher in the legislature isn't going to have bearing on whether or not, you know, how technology might affect the way in which we relate and create families in 2030.
Yeah. Mm, that's fair enough. Yeah. What kind of, as you can tell, I'm asking quite stupid questions, right? Let's be honest.
Question.
Like, what are like really some like false things you've kind of heard of futurology, do you think? Like, has someone said to you a really stupid question that you're like, no, that's not future studies at all? What kind of things have you heard which are like, I know this is quite random, like a question on the spot, but like,
I don't think I've had anything especially stupid. Nothing that comes off, you know, comes to mind off the top of my head. I think a lot of people just kind of think of, you know, like the Jetsons, in the sense that, like, you know, so the show from the 1950s, and everyone kind of thought like, oh, we'd have flying cars and robot maids and all these things. And the closest thing we have is Roombas that like barely work.
Or like, did you have, what are they called? Like Segways.
Segways?
Yeah, yeah. Like you had that, and then they were like, oh, they could be like the newest things, and then everyone's going to be on them in the future. But then, no, probably not. Yeah. And it's like all that kind of misconception. Yeah, that's cool. And then what else do you think are like big misconceptions of the study?
I think just the big thing is just that it's trying to predict the future, and that that if it's not being predictive, then it doesn't have value.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of people seem to have that that idea that if it can't, you know, if it's not creating some kind of statistical probability, like we think this is going to happen with 45% accuracy, this is going to happen with 73, there's a 73% chance that Japan's going to get nuked again or something like that. You know, that's not what it is. And so when people don't see those percentages and those grades of likelihood, they're kind of like, well, what's the point of it? You're just kind of speculating. Well, the point of it is to open your mind, to show you,
yeah,
this is what, you know, the world we have now isn't what it's going to be.
Mm.
And to think that it is, you know, is limiting.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much potential in where we could be, and we have the power to influence that. So, you know, let's aim for something good.
Nice. Yeah. I think this study is super interesting because it is opening my mind up to not trying to predict stuff. Mm-hmm. I think for me, it's quite hard because I'm the type of person that is very like, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and this. But then sometimes when even if it's like, I'm not saying futurology like says certain things day to day. I'm not trying to say that. But like sometimes in a day for me, certain things changes automatically. And then I'm just like, oh, no, I didn't expect that, you know, kind of thing. So it's like, yeah, I think people trying to predict, like trying to do their own day to day life, saying like, right, I'm going to do this, this, and this, and this, and this. Sometimes that day doesn't work out because some random event can happen and it completely changes it, which is quite interesting.
Or if you want to get down to a more basic and ancient level, you go back to Stoicism. A big part of that philosophy is that anger is when something unexpected and bad happens to you.
Mm.
And so what you should do is prepare yourself, you know, be open to all the possibilities of what could happen, including the bad things. Because you only get angry and frustrated when you don't expect that stuff to happen. When you do, and you knew it was going to happen, you knew something bad would happen, or something could have gone bad poorly, you're like, well, it sucks, but I knew it was going to happen. I'm not mad at it.
Mm, that's fair enough. Yeah. It's like, yeah, you're not kind of, yeah.
Mm. And that's kind of what this is. You're just trying to prepare, but on a larger level, you want to prepare society and governments to be for what could happen. So if something bad happens, you're not mad and upset, but rather you're prepared.
Mm. I was in my, just, I'm in my head, just like, because when you've just been speaking about kind of certain futures happening and stuff like that, does climate change kind of apply to this quite well?
Of course.
Yeah, it must do. How can, and do you feel like, you know, people saying, you know, of course they're kind of making, if scientists say like, oh, if temperature is increasing and ice cubes are going to be melting and the water levels will rise, is that like a generally fine thing to kind of say, even though the future isn't predetermined? Is that an okay prediction to make? I don't know, because this is the thing, because with climate change, I find, and relating this with futurology, it's like we don't know what's climate change is going to happen. We don't know what it's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we can say, yes, we can look at natural disasters and say, and because those kind of natural disasters kind of, I'm not saying they happen all the time, but we can say like, okay, usually in this time of year, earthquakes happen, or this time of year, big monsoons are going to happen, right? That's a kind of like, we kind of expect it. But then when climate change has happened and when people are saying like, oh, we're going to be underwater by such and such year, it's like, it's quite a random thing. So how does climate change kind of apply to this study? How can you?
I would say that climate change would just be part, another assumption in terms of when you're constructing your scenario. It also depends on what kind of scenario you're constructing. Are you doing the future of climate change? Or are you doing the future of something else? And you want to see how climate change might impact that.
Okay.
And so when you're doing that, then it's about, well, how could climate change play out? You can have one scenario where we do literally nothing. It's the worst case scenario.
Mm.
Or you can have one where we do manage to reach, you know, net zero emissions by 2050. We do manage to make that. Yeah. Or we fall somewhere in between. Or maybe we do even better.
Mm.
We don't, you know, because we don't know what kind of technology. We can speculate what kind of technologies might come about. We can speculate, you know, maybe the U.S. government collapses or something like that. Or you know, Bernie gets elected. Something totally changes that challenges an assumption of how it works. So for climate change, we can speculate about how it might impact a certain system, but we can always go, well, okay, if climate change goes this way, then we can imagine it might affect it this way. If it doesn't, it does this.
Yeah. So it's kind of, again, it's kind of going back to the point of having different amount of options as well and stuff. And then looking into like the depths of future thinking. So on here I have kind of, so when I was looking at this kind of introduction of this study, that I have like three kind of levels of in-depth future thinking. So mm-hmm. you have like pop futurism, which I was like, what the hell is that? Then you have problem-oriented futures work, and then epistemological futures work. So you can pick out one and kind of explain to the audience, like, what is maybe the last one? What is epistemological futures work? I think I said the word right.
Epistemological futures work. Yes. I'm not an expert, but I don't think I have that episteme.
Yeah.
but I would say that it's epistemology is the field of philosophy concerned with knowledge.
Yes.
What we do and what we can and can't know. What do we and don't we know? And so I would guess that epistemological future studies is about what we can and can't know about the future. Mm. And what kind of statements can we, what can and can't we know? And what statements can we say with any kind of degree of truth?
Yeah, that's fair enough. And then what kind of, yeah, like on top of that, kind of what kind of things can we say can happen and cannot happen? Of course we can't, because...
Yeah, well, again, I'm not...
Yeah. Of course,
I'm
yeah.
not at a...
I won't, yeah. I won't just...
An epistemological futurist.
Of course, yeah. And then...
Or epistemic futurist.
Epistemic, yeah. And then what about problem-oriented futures work? Do you know much about that or not really?
Again, I would be speculating.
Yeah.
That would be more, I'd assume, about a particular issue for... You can either do foresight, a kind of like a broad, general, this is what society might look like. And of course, you can always get down to more granular, you know, this is what the future of the family might look like. This is what the future of, you know, healthcare might look like. This is what the future of the military might look like.
Mm.
And so that's what a lot of these kind of problem-oriented things might be. How is this going? How might this affect that? Or how will the future affect this ongoing problem we're having? For example, like climate change. What's the future of climate change going to be like, or how might, potential futures impact climate change? Because you can have climate change can either impact our potential futures, or we can have our potential futures impact climate change.
So it's kind of like, it's not even just one problem affecting a future; it could be a future affecting a problem. So it's like double way.
Because again, it's affecting us, but we. The future is controlled by us. It's about what we do. So we can have a problem affect us, and how we react to that problem is going to dictate futures.
Yeah. So it's kind of like if companies continually use fossil fuels, for example, then the Earth is increasingly going to increase temperature still. And then, or if we do another future where, let's say, companies actually stop using fossil fuels and look into more eco-friendly ways of producing their products, that's then that future then gets created differently. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's really interesting. It's very like, for me, this study is really cool. I think it sounds really interesting, the fact that it's very like expansive and very like, it's open-mindedness. But the thing is, it's so like considering so many different factors though. Does it make it really confusing though for like a normal person to study? I don't know. Like that's how because even though like we both go to university, right? And I think from like reading it, I was like, okay, I understand it. But then someone just completely out of that situation could be like, what is going on? So could you say that this is trying to explain too much? Not explain too much, but assuming too much? I don't know. Like, I find it's quite a...
It is something that's, you know, some people either get it or don't. Mm. I say it's... I think it's an experiment in imagination.
Mm. Okay.
It's not about... the people... When I worked at Policy Horizons Canada, they were incredibly educated people, you know. Most of them had more than one master's degree. A few of them had PhDs. They were super smart people. But you don't have to be like that you don't have to have a PhD in artificial intelligence and computer science in order to be a good foresight practitioner.
Yeah.
What you need is an imagination.
Mm.
You know, if you're just someone who like enjoys science fiction, you're already on the right path for foresight. All you have to do is be able to just keep your eye, your mind open to see what could be, and what the future might be. And once you have that openness, you're already more receptive to what could be.
Yeah.
And then you can make more robust and flexible decisions in the present that will make it easier for you to go along in the future.
Mm. So it's kind of like... It's just having that imagination, really. It's really just to having that open-mindedness to certain things. A certain world can change so dynamically. And it's true, actually. The world changes so dynamically. Mm-hmm. I think if we And don't say to me if I'm kind of wrong, do you feel like this kind of study is better now than I don't know. Because I feel like maybe this study is good for all times. Mm. It doesn't even matter what time period it is, because it's always looking into the future. Because I was about to say, surely because we kind of knew the world was going in a certain way, but of course, no, sometimes certain change doesn't happen. So maybe this is a good study to have to use across history as well.
It's definitely something that I think works better now, simply in the sense, I mean, a lot of the rules and the facts of it, they're constant throughout history.
Yeah.
But I would say it would be more difficult for someone to see it as useful or even as something that actually happens, you know, 400 or more years ago. In the terms of life was a lot slower.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot less change from generation to generation.
Yeah.
And so if you don't see change in your world, you're not likely to kind of see it that way. So mm-hmm. The future's not predictable is just as unpredictable for a medieval peasant as it is for us. But if that peasant hasn't seen any change in their lives for, you know, 4 generations, they're not really going to see any potential change.
Of course, yeah.
But we can see, you know, the world has changed a lot in our lifetimes alone, and we haven't been around for that long. So it's definitely more useful for us.
Mm.
And I would say that because we're changing, because we can do so much more with technology, because we can do so much now, so much and so quickly, it's definitely something that's going to be more important, especially now that we're, you know, in a globalized world where, you know, the decisions of one community don't just stay in that community, but they affect everyone.
Oh yeah, true. It's the fact that, yeah, like looking to globalization, everyone transfers different nations and stuff. And also the fact big data as well has increased hugely. We've got so much data on our hands, maybe too much, because I was speaking to the interview is going live on Thursday, so this is being pre-recorded, of course, but I had an interview with Matt Betty, who was talking about, he's doing a big data talk, I think it's next week, I believe, and he was talking a lot about the fact I think we've accumulated so much data, but it's become it's kind of a good thing and a bad thing, because we know a lot, but at the same time, we're having so much data, it's trying to then comprehend it is very difficult to kind of properly understand it. We have so much data to use and it's out there, then trying to comprehend it is very interesting, just to kind of try to get it and stuff. And it kind of, you know, looking into I was going to mention Black Mirror and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
I think Black Mirror also uses uses foresight quite a lot, because they're trying to use their episodes to be this might occur, you know, and then they get that, then gives us questions.
That's a lot. That's science fiction. Basically, that's the genre of science fiction is this is, you know, here's something that could plausibly work in the future. Let's imagine that. And that's my point, is that it doesn't matter. All you have to do is just be imaginative. Imagine something different than the world we have now. You're a foresight practitioner.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think it's interesting to look at those episodes and see it. And I just want to ask lastly, where do you see this study going? Now, I know this is really bad to say, because you shouldn't say it as a prediction, but of course, state governments are they increasingly using this kind of study a little bit? So you see, I think you mentioned it was in Wales, they use this kind of study. US, they kind of do a little bit, but
it's definitely something that's becoming, I think, more important for governments. As you're saying, the Welsh Parliament has a minister of the future.
There you go. Yeah.
So rather, it's in their legislature, they have someone who's advocating for the future, because policies we make today affect future generations, but they don't get a say in whether or not policy affects them.
Of course.
And that's actually a really old idea. The Mohawk people, the Haudenosaunee, traditionally, when they make decisions for their people, they would look and to see how that decision would affect 7 generations,
mm-hmm.
to see how, and you know, if it would affect them negatively, they're not going to do it. That's what that is. The US military is largely the only, I think it's the, if not the only, then the major group within the US government that does any kind of foresight.
Yeah.
Otherwise the EPA would probably be a little bit better or whatever.
Yeah.
and then But in terms of like actual specific government agencies, there are a few. Singapore is a leader. Finland's a leader. And the Canadian government's actually a leader.
Yeah, that's what I was about to say. Because I was looking around, I saw quite a few things on Canada that we're doing.
So the within the Canadian federal government, there's an organization called Policy Horizons Canada. And so their mandate is to build foresight capacity, is to do foresight research and to build foresight capacity within the public service. So they kind of do, you know, the big picture kind of imaging of, like, kind of do big picture and see what, you know, kind of get conversations going. And then they also work with individual government agencies to help them incorporate foresight into their own policy analysis. Because most government agencies are kind of going along the same kind of election cycle. They're only looking 5 years into the future or so. Policy Horizons looking more 10 to 15. And so it's to help them build more robust long-term policies. So like when Transport Canada is going to make their, you know, their plan, it's a lot, it's better for them to incorporate, okay, well, what kind of, what's the world going to be like in 2030, 2035? Are we going to still have cars? Are we going to have trains? What are the kinds of means of transportation we're going to have? What are the problems we're going to face? And it's a lot it's a lot better if Transport Canada can develop a robust policy that could be flexible in those future scenarios now, then create a scenario, then create a policy that they think will work in 5 years, and then have to constantly rework that policy in the, you know, every 5 years or so.
And in that, and in that way, it kind of creates maybe better governance as well, hugely, because then people are kind of less like calling for change, and it's less, it's way more, okay, if you have a policy that looks into, let's say, 10, 15, 20 years, then there's less likelihood of people coming in and being like, oh, we need to change it and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's, you want, it's to make government a little bit more proactive.
Yes.
And if it gets, you know, if these things can be taken seriously enough, then it's about also, can the government help us work towards these preferred futures? You know, is the government just going to pass, you know, is it the government that passively lets, waits around and lets the market determine whether, what kind of future we get, and whether, or is it just, is the government going to, you know, just work to avoid the terrible futures, or you know, is the government going to help work towards bringing us a preferred future?
Yeah.
And even then, it's the question of, well, whose preferred future is it?
Yes, I was about to mention, actually. Yeah, what happens then if we have so many, because everyone else's futures are very different from each other, like that's them managing, it's quite difficult, isn't it? Yeah,
well, of course, that gets down to a question of human values, but it's more of one, it's, I would say you'd probably want to have a future that, you know, works best for everyone. One that, you know, gives everyone the freedom, equality, and dignity they deserve as human beings.
But just, I mean, who might think that, though? That's the thing, you know? Big question,
giving people human dignity? What?
Well, you never know. Hey, like, people can be bad people.
Oh, of course.
But you never know. But yeah, we'll just leave that on that last note. But so yeah, thank you for talking about futurology and me asking some good questions and some bad questions, let's be honest. But
you had them, I'm sure our listeners had them.
Oh yeah, of course. But I think it's good to have that conversation about this, because I think we definitely will see futurology as a tool to be used, definitely to predict, to have foresight in the future, and to hopefully be used by state governments.
And we'll post an image of the cone of plausibility in the show notes, and if you ever want to read up more, I'd recommend going on to the website for Policy Horizons Canada. They do for foresight for the Canadian government. They have some reports on the future of work, the future of the economy, along with some training modules about foresight.
Okay.
So if you want to learn more about that, go
there. Yeah, definitely go there. Perfect. Yeah. Okay. Thank you so much, John, for coming in. And stay tuned next week for another episode. You can find this episode on Spotify if you type in like Future Friday, Hamish Hallett, I believe, and then you can find it there. Or find us on Anchor as well. So yeah, have a great day, guys. Thank you.